Hi everybody, once again I would be Craig Eastman coming to you from just outside Liverpool, and as ever in Glasgow would be oneliner.com creator and guru Scott Morris.
Hey, how you doing?
And in Falkirk there would be no less than the mighty, mighty Drew Tavendale.
How you do?
We've got a bit of a mixed bag for you tonight. There's a couple of biggie summer films in there, and also the obligatory Brit sci-fi horror film. So without further ado, we'll kick off and hopefully enlighten you on some of the most recent releases kicking about your multiplex. First tonight, we're going to talk about Outpost, which is all about a group of mercenaries who stumble, as you do, upon an old World War II bunker, which turns out to be full of nasty, ghostly, murdering people. Guys, it seems to me like a bit of a cliche now, this whole sort of, oh look, a bunker, oh, it's full of evil. What's the story with this?
Yeah, it's sort of like they couldn't decide whether to make a war film or a horror film, so they just try to do a bit of both. As you say, a bunch of multicultural mercenaries headed by Ray Stevenson are called on to investigate a seemingly deserted bunker at the behest of Hunt, Julian Wadham and his mysterious company, and anyone familiar with horror films will have already latched onto that seemingly in front of the deserted bit there. Knows about, find a bunch of Nazi memorabilia and a big pile of bodies, not all of which are entirely dead, with one decrepit old codger heaving himself out of the pile to the general surprise of all concerned. Chalking this bonus corpse pile up to a local warlord doing a spot of ethnic cleansing, they go about their business and find a machine in the basement, which turns out to be the ultimate goal of the exercise. After degromulating the nerve flanges and reorientating the discombobulators, it seems that it's some sort of horrible Nazi device for manipulating unified fields, or something needlessly grounded in reality for a gadget that essentially makes invincible Nazi zombies.
It's Einstein's little known zombificator.
Yeah, so it's more like a weapons of Command and Conquer Red Alert 2 or something, isn't it?
E equals zombies squared.
So this little gang of mercenaries attempt to fight off the remnants of the Third Reich, and that works about as well as you'd expect when you're up against invincible Nazi zombies. I didn't think there's actually much wrong in real terms with Outpost.
Really?
It mixes action and horror a lot better than Doomsday did, put it that way. But that's damning it with very faint praise indeed.
Yes, very faint praise, absolutely.
The only real problem I've got with it is that it never manages to make much of a connection with an audience, or at least this section of an audience, or at least me. It's competently done, but it's difficult to get worked up about it, for the most part having your heroes be grizzled ex-military hired killers kind of makes it difficult to actually feel any sort of sympathy for them at all. And so
swear quite a lot?
Yes, they do.
Yes, there's a fair bit of swearing, which is only to be expected when you're being attacked by invincible Nazi zombies. it's okay, but there's never really any sort of real suspense in there, because they do seem to be completely unstoppable, and don't you know what they actually are? So, it's something of a disappointment in that terms, but it's still better executed than the vast bulk of horror films that I've seen in the last decade.
I've got a couple of questions for you. How many zombies are there, roughly?
Millions.
No, there's maybe 40.
Right, so there's maybe 40, 50 zombies there, right. What sort of time span does the film take place over?
A couple of days.
And how many mercenaries are there?
Six or seven, is it somewhere?
Yeah, about that.
So this great Nazi weapon create zombies which take two days to kill six or seven people. I can't see this weapon working in the long term. What were they thinking? There you go, one star. No, I mean, but overall, is it worthwhile taking time out to go and see this, or is it just going to be something that you catch up with on Channel 4 in about a year's time?
You know what, honestly, no. I mean, it's been released straight to DVD in most parts of the world, apart from here, for a reasonably good reason. It's typical horror fare. It's maybe a little better than you just standard run-of-the-mill sort of teen slashers, which I just can't be bothered with anymore. And it shows a little more class and inventiveness than that. But not enough to actually warrant anyone rushing out to see it.
Yeah, I mean, as a film, it's really not particularly interesting. You don't care about the characters, and at the end, oh, what happened to that? Well, some stuff happened, and it ended.
Well, that's pretty much any film, isn't it? Some stuff happened, yeah, and it ended.
As a film, it's not particularly rewarding, I wouldn't seek it out. But given the budget it's made on, it's a reasonably promising thing in terms of filmmakers themselves and what they've managed to do with such a small budget, shot in such a short time.
Is it about on a par with Death Watch or thereabouts?
No, Death Watch is better. Go and see Death Watch instead if you. That's a better choice when you're in the DVD emporium.
So there you go. Not necessarily worth taking too much time out of your schedule to catch up with, and I strongly suspect that may be the general consensus with What Happens in Vegas, in which through a hugely contrived set of circumstances, Ashton Kutcher and Cameron Diaz end up having to stay married for some period of time in order to keep a large amount of money. I suspect I've probably wasted more breath than that deserves anyway. Who's telling us about this one?
I'll let you know about this, and it'll take more breath, but there's plenty of oxygen to spare. Although, unfortunately, that includes for Ashton Kutcher.
Yes.
What Happens in Vegas is a story of two New Yorkers, stockbroker Joy McNally, played by Cameron Diaz, and factory worker Jack Fuller, who's played by Ashton Kutcher, who, after respectively having had their engagement ended in embarrassing fashion and being sacked for slacking off, head out west to Las Vegas to drown their sorrows. After meeting an oh-so-hilarious hotel room mix-up, the two of them head off together to paint the town red and wake up in the morning in an entirely original way to find that they've been married. Shock horror! And after a short bout of, oh, what a terrible idea, quick to the divorce court, they unexpectedly win $3 million in the slot machine and, unsurprisingly, both make a claim on it. So off they head back to their homes in New York, where they seek a divorce in order to get their share of the money. But much to their dismay, the judge freezes the funds and orders them to attempt to make the marriage work for a period of 6 months. Hating each other to begin with, they each try to force the other to break the terms of the court order so that they forfeit the money. Eventually, and to the surprise of absolutely no one whatsoever, they fall for each other and instead try to make something real of their sham marriage. So far, so predictable, and it is, frankly, piss poor, and barely managed to raise even a smile throughout the entire running time. The script from the writer of the equally atrocious The Wedding Date is leaden, puerile and inept, and it's utterly devoid of any laughs whatsoever. The acting from all involved is wooden, and the leads are deeply unlikable, which is a definite problem if you're making a romantic comedy. Ashton Kutcher, as you'd expect, lives up to every bit of the potential he showed in The Butterfly Effect, without the redeeming aspect of the unintentionally comic acting served up when he was called upon to pretend he had woken up to discover his arms were missing. Cameron Diaz's character is prickly and obnoxious, and a romantic comedy where both of the leads are so difficult to warm to is never going to get out of the starting blocks. It suggests strongly you give it a very wide berth, and if you really want to watch something about drunken weddings in Las Vegas and their aftermath, I direct you towards the Simpsons episode Viva Ned Flanders, which is everything this film is not. Well acted, well written, and funny. And that's enough oxygen wasted on that, I think.
Scott, are you in concurrence?
It wasn't quite as intolerable as expecting, entirely on the basis that Rob Corddry of The Daily Show was in it with a fairly extensive supporting role. And it's the only time there's even a spark of life is when he's on screen, and it's not a particularly original role, but there is some element of humour in him essentially at random shouting, "I am the law, bitches," after winning a court case and other sort of just completely random things. And that is essentially the only redeeming feature in it, and by the time the saccharine-drenched ending came round, I was about ready to vomit in my nose.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I'm just... to interrupt you there a moment, Scott, but I mean, I didn't even find that entertaining. I just found that character irritating, so I didn't even find that a redeeming feature.
If you're left with a choice between this and Sex and the City, I would probably rather see this, but it's a bit of a Hobson's choice there.
No doubt.
Yeah, certainly it's an unremarkable rom-com, and again, not recommended in the slightest.
Cool. Well, let's not waste any more oxygen on Ashton Kutcher then, as Drew rightfully suggests. Hoping to tickle you in a similar way, well, hopefully a much greater way than that atrocity, would be Harold and Kumar's Escape from Guantanamo Bay, which picks up where the first film left off, with our pot-smoking heroes, or anti-heroes, boarding their flight to Amsterdam. Fortunately, having decided to smuggle a bong on board, they are naturally mistaken for terrorists, and all manner of hilarity must surely ensue as they're whisked off to Guantanamo Bay. Scott, I quite enjoyed the first Harold and Kumar film for what it was. Does this one even bear any resemblance?
See, I'd actually dodged the first Harold and Kumar film. I'd sort of lumped it into the same category in my head as American Pie and that sort of thing, which I now realise is entirely incorrect. What you have here is a fairly minimalist plot. The plot itself, much like the first one, isn't really there to drive things along rather than just being an excuse to have these little bizarre vignettes. Their actual escape from Guantanamo Bay, where they're packed off to it, the dim-witted G-man Ron Fox, played by Rob Corddry, is fairly swift in coming, and it's basically just an attempt for them to revisit many of the characters from the last film and trying to get Kumar back together with his old flame Vanessa, played by Danielle Harris. It just sets up a whole bunch of oddball situations, including Neil Patrick Harris tripping off his tits in a whorehouse running around with a branding iron. And you know what? It's actually pretty damn good. The first 5 minutes do a fairly decent job of putting you off it with our complete reliance on just toilet humour, which definitely turned me off, but it soon gets much, much better, albeit not much more sophisticated. But there are moments of left field genius that's more than worth the price of admission. But since watching this, I've since went back to the first film, and I also approve of that. I'm almost on the verge of saying that the second film's a little better than the first, although there's probably a valid criticism in saying that they're very much alike to the point of being near enough identical. But they're both funny, so who cares? It's not going to convert haters of the first film, but who cares about them? This might be a somewhat flippant review, but who cares about that?
Yeah, well, don't hate the player, hate the game.
Yeah.
Drew, are you in concurrence with those opinions? Or?
Yeah, I'd only gone to see it because there was sod all else on to see at the cinema last weekend, and I too avoided the first one, clearly unfairly lumping it in with the likes of American Pie, thinking, oh great, more shitty teen American comedy. And I'm really rather glad I went to see it, because it is bloody funny in parts. It's nothing hugely memorable, it's not going to blow you away, but it is entertaining, it's funny, has genius moments, most of which involve Neil Patrick Harris and unicorns. But even the two leads, when playing typical stoner characters, but it's not, you perhaps might not think about it, but the performances from the actors are actually pretty damn good, because they're so invested in the characters to the point where they believe their standpoint very, very strongly, and it makes it all the funnier for it. Like their declaration that donuts are awesome. And who could argue? Yeah, it's recommended. It's not going to stay with you at all. You're not going to probably want to watch it again. Much rerun value in it, but it's funny, it's light, and I recommend it.
Superb. That's what we like to hear. So there you go. If you liked the first one, check it out. If you didn't like the first one, you're a dick. Cassandra's Dream is the latest from Woody Allen. It stars Ewan McGregor and Colin Farrell as brothers. And it's not been receiving the best of press. Drew, why would that be?
Because it's not any good, would be the short answer.
But
the somewhat longer answer, I'll tell you a bit about the film. As you said, Ewan McGregor and Colin Farrell play Ian and Terry, brothers from London, though their accents beg to differ.
Did you say Ian and Terry?
Yes.
I was thinking you don't get much more London than that, do you? Right, Ian. Right, Terry.
Terry spends his days as a car mechanic to make enough money to fund his gambling habit and buy a house, while Ian works in his father's struggling restaurant while waiting for one of his innumerable business schemes to take off. After a spectacular £90,000 poker loss, Terry approaches Ian to help him get out of his financial hole and keep his legs intact. Eventually, they turn to their rich, successful Uncle Howard, Tom Wilkinson, who agrees to bail Terry out and fund Ian's hotel business venture in return for the smallest of favours, i.e. off his business partner Martin Burns before he can grasshole how he'd up to the feds. The brothers proceed to go through a spot of soul-searching and hand-wringing, deciding whether to go through with the dirty deed or not, the central point of the film being how far they're prepared to go to make their dreams come true. And the outcome is going to come as no surprise to anyone, but by that point you're probably not going to care anyway. Woody Allen's love for his native New York is legendary, but it seems to be matched only by his apparent apathy for London, begging the question of why he seems so intent on making movies there now. So little use is made of the city and anything recognisable in it in terms of both landmark and culture that one wonders why it's set there at all anyway. This puzzlement over choice of location is reinforced by his bizarre decision to cast Colin Farrell and Ewan McGregor as the brothers. The supposed torture of their souls while dealing with Uncle Howard's proposals is considerably less than the torture inflicted by their accents. To that is added the presumably mid-Atlantic tone of Tom Wilkinson's Howard, though this seems to bear as much resemblance to real Earth accent as did Anthony Hopkins in The World's Fastest Indian. Perhaps the worst element, though, is Woody Allen's script, which is turgid and entirely lacking in the snappy dialogue for which he's rightly regarded. The actors trudge through scene after uninteresting scene, appearing to have had no direction whatsoever, unless he asked them specifically to perform like it was a half-arsed read-through in pre-production. It's completely devoid of any tension whatsoever, and the film plods along for what seems like an eternity until, finally, drama conspicuously fails to happen. Things are not aided by an identikit assault on the ears, otherwise known as a Philip Glass score, with his dislike of more than three notes. And it's just very disappointing that Colin Farrell, who's already appeared in one of the best films of the year, should also be in this, which is likely to be one of the worst. Given the talent involved in the movie, it's a spectacular failure, and my advice is strongly to avoid it.
One question for you. Who's Cassandra?
Well, we're introduced to these two brothers as they scheme to buy a boat together, which they then call Cassandra's Dream, and then the boat is never really referred to in any meaningful sense for the rest of the film, so I really don't understand what the point of it was.
Yeah, Cassandra also is the daughter of King Priam of Troy, who was turned into an oracle by Apollo but made to never be believed in Greek mythology. And none of that seems to have any relevance to the plot of the film whatsoever, since it seems to be an entirely meaningless name, which is useful.
Far out.
There's so little meat to the plot in this film that it comes down to a kind of character study, which is unfortunate because, as you say, Farrell and McGregor put in such downright awful performances that it seems to be almost intentionally bad. Sorry, excuse me for a minute, guys. Mr. Allen, Woody. Can I call you Woody? People like myself have been saying for years that you ought to be making films outside of the radius of the three blocks in Manhattan that you make 90-odd percent of your films. I accept now that I was wrong. Go home, Woody. Please, go home. In London, it's clear you're out of your element, Woody. You have no frame of reference. You're like a child who has wandered into the middle of my country and suddenly thinks he understands our peculiar class structures and the dialect of the people of this country. And you don't, and that's why you've not noticed that the dialogue's unfeasibly clunky, and it's why you've not realised that Farrell and McGregor sound nothing like Londoners and more what you might think Londoners would sound like if your only experience of it is, I don't know, Mary Poppins. Like I say, it's a dreadful film because it's hinged entirely on the performance of Farrell and McGregor, and they put in bad performances, so it's a bad film. One of the writers for The Guardian said that it was the worst film he's ever seen, which is, I think, overstating it a bit, but probably not by all that much. It's amateurish and clunky, and like you say, for all the talent on board this film, it's a terrible, terrible disappointment that they can't produce something sort of halfway decent.
Oh, it's a surprise.
It's the worst Woody Allen film that I've seen, and if it wasn't for the dual horrors of Doomsday and Happy Go Lucky, it'd be the worst film set in Britain of the year easily.
That's a bit of a shame, because I quite enjoyed Matchpoint.
So did I. I was going to say, I've never been a massive Woody Allen fan, but I've always been able to appreciate his dialogue particularly. And in this, it's like he didn't even bother. It's not even so much that he clearly doesn't understand London life and the way people speak in London. He's obviously, as you say, has no frame of reference. He doesn't know what he's doing and what the soul of the city is. But even then, it doesn't appear to have tried at all. It's like he banged out the script in 30 minutes one night.
Well, what's gone wrong is he stopped starring in his own films, and consequently there are now no longer any massively neurotic Jews kicking about in his film, so that, there you go, that's what's gone wrong.
I don't know, I do like Woody Allen films, but I'm getting the impression that Woody Allen can only really write for Woody Allen doing his own films, and I think it's been an issue since then, because even the ones that he's done lately where he's not been the star of and he's been directing, ones like, I'm thinking of, was it Melinda and Melinda, the one with Will Ferrell, and that was only good because you had Will Ferrell essentially doing a Woody Allen impersonation, and I just don't think he knows how to write characters that aren't him.
Exactly.
For the most part, is what seems to be what's going down.
Woody, go home. Get in the first plane you can and go somewhere other than here. That's not a request, that's an order.
So, ladies, gentlemen, welcome to the insert section, where only one of the crew could actually be bothered to watch these specific films due to a general lack of enthusiasm. Coming up later, I'll be waffling endlessly about the eye. But first, here's Craig, who drew the short straw and had to cover Sex and the City.
If I've told you once, I've told you a million times. The Filipino boys must have no teeth. Oh, sorry about that, guys. Thanks for joining me here on my desert island. It's nice to get away sometimes, don't you think? Anyway, I understand you may be interested in hearing about Sex and the City. And while I may be on my desert island, I am still dedicated to taking a hit for you all as often as I can. To this end, I've instructed my monkey butler Hugo to build a screening room and source me a print so that I might impart upon you my wisdom. So here goes. It's been well over 4 years since the last episode of Sex and the City debuted on air, but in that time its following of Shopaholic, Heat Reading Acolytes has lost none of its hunger for the escapades of New York author Carrie Bradshaw and our well-to-do Manhattan clique. The action in the movie picks up in real time, with the series characters all having settled into various states of domestic bliss over the last 4 years. All that is except Carrie, played as always by Sarah Jessica Parker, who remains resolutely single within the capacity of a relationship with Big, embodied as always by Chris Noth, here almost disappearing underneath an avalanche of makeup. Within the first half hour, Big pops the big question. Carrie accepts, plans everything down to the last oh-so-trendy detail, and manages to narc Big off with her incessant fashionista bent to such a degree that he rather understandably changes his mind at the last minute. Cure amateur hour histrionics from Carrie and friends. Of course, I call Big's actions understandable from the context of being a man, and, as such, I probably set myself forth as a feminist piñata, for unless you're the kind of guy who steps lightly in his loafers, Sex and City doesn't really give a hoot what you think. You insensitive, self-centred bastard, you. What follows is an overly long, drawn-out mishmash of domestic strife, girly bonding, equal opportunities PA recruitment, you-go-girlfriend backslapping, and above all, product placement. What you won't find is plot, character development, or any kind of quality acting. I was never a fan of the series to begin with, but I did at least find it to be occasionally witty, occasionally knowing, and above all, feisty. So sitting down to watch it with one's girlfriend at the time never felt like too much of a chore. Unfortunately, that sassiness has been hideously diluted as Carrie and friends weary with age, and with it leaves all that made the TV episodes at least tolerable for those like myself. What's left is a quagmire of the aforementioned product placements, hellishly vague introspection, and a liberal sprinkling of offensively bland gay stereotypes that neither manages to say anything useful about the 40-something female urbanite, nor entertain to any acceptable degree. The one thing I will concede is that while it may be bland, Sex and the City is at least largely not terrible, although it might have proven useful to whack 40 minutes off the running time. Indeed, this film falls into the same trap as most TV crossovers, coming across as a perfectly good episode from television, needlessly padded out with scripted polyfiller, and at well over 2 hours, Sex and the City is pushing its luck a good deal further than most others. I have to admit that I am at least pleased to see the embryo of the female-oriented summer blockbuster, for if we menfolk can enjoy giant robots smashing the hell out of each other and other such vapid pursuits, then why shouldn't the girls have their own tailor-made brains-off blockbusters? I just can't help feel but they deserve a whole lot better. And will someone please tell Sarah Jessica Parker she looks like a horse? Now, where was I? Hugo? Let me see you do that strange naked dance again.
The Eye sees directorial duo David Moreau and Xavier Palut strap themselves to the ever-popular Asian horror remake rocket and propel themselves in the general direction of 2002's well-regarded original effort from the best-named directors working today, Danny and Oxide Pang. Sydney Wells, played by Jessica Alba, is blind, which is a pain, but she soon receives donor corneas, enabling her to see, which is nice. However, it soon becomes apparent that Sydney is seeing weird shit start happening, like Vanilla Ice trying to rap again. Well, that and freaky apparitions and dead people and whatnot. While her doctor, played by Alessandro Nivola, is rather keen to write this off as a maladjustment of a brain not used to filtering visual reality, for reasons that escape me, he agrees to Sydney's plans to travel to Mexico to find out who the donor for her crazy eyeballs were, and see if they can't get to the bottom of what these recurring nightmarish visions pretend. There's a very specialised subgenre of this sort of transplant horror that's been around about as long as transplantation has, and in this case it dovetails with the investigation element that's commonly found in recent Asian horrors since, and well, let's give it the obligatory mention now and get out of the way, The Ring. Now then, it's not following the usual teen-orientated horror traditions of throwing loud noises and buckets of blood at you, instead going for a somewhat more refined approach of creeping vicarious concern that a part of your body is working against you, seeking your downfall, as well as from some well-realised effects as Sydney's visions encroach more and more on reality. There's nothing wrong with that approach, and indeed I applaud it wholeheartedly. However, it does demand a fairly large amount of the star called upon to carry this through. While the excellent Naomi Watts was capable of this in the Western redo of The Ring, Jessica Alba doesn't have quite the chops to convince that she's in the grip of either real horror or in real danger. She does well enough to at least hold my interest in the investigatory elements of the piece, and I can't deny that she's a pretty thing to behold. So it's a decent enough film, if not one that I'm going to advise that you rush out and see. Given the state of the horror genre these days, that practically makes it the most highly regarded horror of the year. Of course, now, as so often happens these days, we're left with the question of whether or not a remake of this was particularly necessary. It's not too much of a stretch to say that, language and a layer of gloss aside, it's essentially the same film as the 6-year-old original, and this new version doesn't actually improve on it, so it's exceedingly mildly recommended. So, all in all, this hasn't been a particularly uplifting insert segment. Ah well, what say we just chalk it up to experience and plunge straight back into our regularly scheduled podcast.
We're going to wrap up tonight by discussing what is undoubtedly the biggest film of the year so far, and which in terms of expectation and hype may well turn out to be one of the biggest films of the year, and that would be Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. Gone are the days of the Nazi scum. It's now the 1950s, and this time around a slightly older and slightly more decrepit Dr. Indiana Jones will be cracking his whip in the face of commie scum headed up by Kate Blanchett, no less, as a psychic KGB woman. Guys, I'm of mixed opinion on Indiana Jones. I think I feel most let down because we've come to expect so much from, well, even Temple of Doom was a great film in its own right, just as an adventure film. I think my expectation is what's let me down most about this latest film. It's probably fair to say it's not terrible, but it's nowhere near as good as the others, is it?
What I like about this film is that it looks like an indie film, and it sounds like an indie film, and it feels like an indie film, and for all I know it tastes like an indie film. It's just not a great indie film. It's just not in the same league as the other three, and I don't know if I'm actually being quite lenient on this just because I like the other three so much. I mean, I can't imagine if you'd had any other film where your hero survives a nuclear explosion by climbing inside a lead-lined fridge, I would be granting it the same level of leeway. But it kind of works here. I think, again, just mainly because of Harrison Ford, he's still got that kind of laconic wit, and he's one of the few heroes that actually seems to be in real danger and in imminent danger of dying sort of every second of the film, and that's what makes Indiana Jones work compared to your usual sort of completely invulnerable superheroes, and that's at least something different to what we normally get. As the rest of it, I mean, there's certainly weak points. Kate Blanchett, generally, Kate Blanchett's accent.
Well, which veers between, I don't know, American, Russian, Dr. Evil.
Again, I'm letting that away because it's a sort of comedy bad accent, which you'd kind of expect in this sort of thing. But again, I think maybe I'm just being too lenient with it because it's Indian. He's got a hat and a whip. Wow.
Well, I'm not going to be lenient with it. I was really disappointed. I don't think it did look and feel like an Indiana Jones film. I think, unfortunately, we're in the age of CG now, and Messrs. Lucas and Spielberg can't leave it the hell alone.
I don't know, the only thing that was annoying me was those bloody chipmunks at the start. I have no idea what that was going to be.
I was going to say, having been promised by Steven Spielberg that no, there'll be hardly any CG in this, it'll all be actual stuntwork, blah, 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 there won't be a heck of a lot of CG in it, we're going to use all the old techniques. So what does he do? He opens the film with a shot of a bloody...
I always assumed it was like a tribute to the gophers from Caddyshack.
He opens the film with a shot of a shit CG gopher. Do you know what the problem is? Is that Steven Spielberg needs to have a quiet word with George Lucas and say, look, George, this whole thing of us being mates isn't working anymore. You're actually quite shit, and everything that you have any hand in whatsoever turns to shit. So fuck off, George. And actually, that's just a statement I'd like to make in general. Fuck off, George. I'm going to get some T-shirts printed up. And if anybody wants a T-shirt, drop us an email at theoneliner.com and I'll send the first five people a free T-shirt. There you go.
I haven't seen the trailers for the animated Star Wars monstrosity that's coming out later this year, I think. But I'm inclined to agree. Yeah, fuck off, George.
I would have one of those T-shirts, but I would add the proviso that Steven Spielberg's hardly innocent. This is the man who, the special edition DVD release of E.T., went back and used CGI to turn all the guns to walkie-talkies. The man's not innocent
himself. Yeah, exactly. And that E.T. being what he still states to be his favourite film, he would go back and do that to it. Drew, what did you think of Indy 4?
I was disappointed in it. I'd been looking forward to it for so long, after having spent a long time burying, thinking, the Indiana Jones film, George Lucas will ruin that too. And then I started getting excited seeing the trailers, thinking, they seem to have got the tone right. And I thought, I would more towards Scott's opinion than yours, and I feel that it did feel and look mostly like an indie film, but it was very much diet indie. Oh, one calorie.
There was nothing spectacular in there that wasn't sort of CG, I'm sorry, but it was still CG, and quite obviously CG, and it just detracts from any sort of... uninterested by the whole thing. I thought it lacked...
That's not true. There was those completely glaring back-projected bits. They definitely weren't CG.
No. Well, this is the thing, though, is that I've been made to look back-projected, but I don't believe for a second they actually were back-projected. They've told us that was the sort of technique they were going to use, and I'm sorry, but they weren't back-projected. I'll guarantee you they weren't.
No, it was all great, but it's just nothing like it could have or should have been. And I was disappointed. But I had to decide whether it would be a better film either with or without the originals. And I don't know. It's not a patch in any of the original films, even Temple of Doom.
I don't think had it been an indie film it would have fared very well at all. I think it operates on a huge reserve of goodwill.
Yeah, I'll actually agree with you for at least that part, because I remember you could chart my enthusiasm on a graph that went steadily downhill the longer the film went on. I mean, I was sort of, when the first sort of quarter of an hour or 20 minutes, I was like, yeah, this is showing National Treasure in Sahara and all that sort of nonsense, how it should be done, and then by the end of it, I was just kind of going, yeah, okay, you've got some aliens messing about in some silly plot and whatnot, and... For all the people that are saying this is a silly plot, could you please go back and look at the original three and have them? You know, they're talking about the powers lost in the Holy Ark and all this kind of nonsense. It's never been particularly sensible. The fact that it's space aliens rather than space gods doesn't make it any more stupid. Well, it's just the same level of stupid.
This is the thing, and I had to hold my hands up after we left the cinema, and I think I mentioned it to you guys, that I spent the last sort of 20 minutes of the film going, aliens, oh fuck off. And then, of course, I found myself outside thinking, yeah, well, I did quite like Independence Day, though, didn't I? I'm not entirely sure why I wasn't prepared to let Indiana Jones away with it when I will any other film. there you go.
I said to both of you when we left the cinema, too, that I was part of me was rebelling. Those aliens, that's just a really stupid ending. But then I had absolutely no problem with the ending of the other films. It was all, well, the first and third one, which had a religious basis, too. And religious myths, someone bought into that as being part of the film. So why on earth?
As though any known religion is any less silly than the idea of space aliens.
Yeah, it's possibly that it would be in space, and deeply unlikely as it is, it's the one that has more chance of being real than anything else. And I was thinking it's really, really stupid, but I had no problem with the end of the Holy Grail whatsoever, and I loved the Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade.
Mm.
So it's kind of hard, just particularly strange, since I love science and hate religion, that bothered me, but it's kind of hard to get over that, even if the part of my brain that's thinking rationally is then that's just silly. You'd be hypocritical.
Well, if I tell you what, though, if Lucas has had his way, it's not even rumours, I suppose it's fact, actually. Lucas originally had approved a script and he wanted to call it Indiana Jones and the Saucer Men from Mars. Which I think actually there's a line in there in which Harrison Ford said something about saucer men from Mars, which is obviously a knowing wink. So how much of that script survived in this one, I don't know. But
personally, I think Indiana Jones versus the space aliens from space has a certain ring to
yes.
it. Get behind that.
Exactly. No, I've got to say I was quite disappointed by it, and I'm not going to let it off just because it was an indie film. There were a couple of nice moments in it, but then there were a couple of really stupid moments, including one where Shia LaBeouf swings through the forest on vines following a gaggle of monkeys, which would just...
Are you saying having a personal army of commando monkeys is in some way not awesome? Because I'm revoking your privileges, Carl.
I'm saying on this occasion it was bloody stupid.
The monkeys looked terrible. It was yet more rotten CGI, which I'm just so, so fed up of. But I love monkeys. Monkeys is awesome.
Well, we'll agree to disagree on that.
Yes, but you're wrong again.
I know we don't normally throw this about in the podcast, but if you're thinking stars, what would you give this? I mean, I'm sort of leaning at sort of 3.5.
I'm thinking just 3.
I would say 3, but the very bottom end of 3.
3 must try harder.
I would actually rather they didn't try it again.
I would just say 3 out of 5. Yeah. Shouldn't have done it. Fuck off, George.
Yeah. Stop, George, now.
Can we get some sort of campaign going here, actually? Can we get that? Can we get that as a slogan? I copyright that.
Just stop.
Just get everybody to watch the South Park episode called Free Hat, because that has it spot on. George Lucas seems to be ordering me to stop from messing about with their films.
What we need to do is actually answer that age-old question of physics and get George Lucas and Uwe Boll in a room together and see what happens when an unstoppable force meets an immovable object. None of us may live to find out the results, but it would certainly be interesting.
It'll probably be House of the Dead remastered to have no zombies.
Oh my god, no. The zombies have all been replaced by pillowcases. Nah, I'm not going to let Indiana Jones off the hook. I wouldn't recommend anybody to go and see it, I'll be honest with you. I'm sure on any one given day of the week you're going to have something better to do than see Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. So there you go. That's what I think anyway. So anyway, guys, we're going to end it on that. Go and see whatever you like. We don't really care. We know you're not going to listen to us anyway. You've probably seen Indiana Jones already, and that makes me angry. Remember, email us and I'll send you a t-shirt. I'm not kidding. I want to start this. I want to get the ball rolling on this thing. George Lucas, look out, boy, coming at you. Take care, guys. As always, I've been Craig Eastman, and it's goodbye from me and from Scott.
See you on the flip side.
And from the man who's sounding increasingly like R2-D2, Drew.
Goodbye.
One small point of housekeeping. Myself and hopefully also Drew will be off covering the impending Edinburgh Film Festival over the next few weeks, so expect some form of regular podcast to be coming from that fairly soon in a format yet to be determined. It will be awesome. For us at least, if not you guys.
Yeah, keep it real, guys, and we'll speak to you again soon. Bye-bye! Go and see Death Watch and ask yourself one question.
You're trying to kill me!
There's something wrong with this place.